Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
When you need auto parts, O'ReillyAuto.com is just a click away. We offer convenient options for you to get your parts, tools, accessories, and supplies quickly. Order online and pick up for free at your local O'Reilly Auto Parts store, or you can have your parts delivered right to your door with free shipping on most orders over $35. Visit O'ReillyAuto.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Judd Apatow is coming up for a very revealing one-on-one. Real thoughtful guy. And funny, by the way. First, I'll tell you about J.B. Weld. This stuff I use, I actually have a box of it in my car because I took all the stuff I needed for my house and I put it in my drawer in my garage, and now I'm taking some over to my shop. You're doing a DIY project. A lot of people are getting back in touch with their garage roots and their projects and everything. And that's the one good thing that may come from this whole pandemic. Let's use the good stuff, J.B. Weld. You don't want to use ordinary glue because ordinary glue has the word ordinary in it, and that's not you. You want J.B. Weld in your toolbox or your kitchen drawer, craft room, and whatever. They've been around for over 50 years. Wood, metal, plastic, and more. Don't J.B. Weld it. Or I should say, don't glue it, J.B. Welded. I hung out with these guys at SEMA. They're nice. And I just went over there and I started talking glue with them because I've always been a fan of J.B. Weld. Now they do everything. And you can get it at jbweld.com, Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, O'Reilly, Walmart, Amazon, Michaels, and more. J.B. Weld.
The Adam Carolla Show salutes the winners of the COVID-19 pandemic. Office bad hygiene guy. Yeah, you're the dude your coworkers can smell two cubicles away. No one has ever had the heart to tell you your deodorant ain't working, if you even use any. And no one's ever wanted to get close enough to see if that smell on your breath was your lunch or if you have a dead tooth. But now you work from home and blissfully bask in your own stink unaware. And when you go out, the mask mandate means you are the only victim of your medical-grade halitosis. So congratulations, office bad hygiene guy. You are the winner of COVID-19.
Judd Apatow is joining us. Of course, writer-director, stand-up comedian. Don't sleep on the stand-up comedy just because you're a great writer and a great director. Let's not sleep on Judd Apatow's stand-up comedy. The King of Staten Island's the name of the movie. It's available on demand June 12th. I watched it last night, and I have many complimentary thoughts.
Oh, thank you very much.
It was as you progress or as you mature as a filmmaker, I feel like you're just getting into more nuanced kind of human stories and less broader, you know, based humor. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I mean, I think my intentions early were to try to make a movie that was as funny as like the hard comedy movies that I love that also were credible emotionally and good stories, but I certainly was thinking I'd like to tear the house down every 10 minutes. And there were a lot of movies at that time that were kind of amazing, like Something About Mary. Right. And I always thought, you know, can you combine that kind of high comedy with real emotions? And I think, you know, this movie, I thought, well, this is a drama and I hope it's funny enough for people, but I'm going to value the story most, and it'll be as funny as it's going to be. It'll reveal itself to me how funny it should be because there's a lot of colorful people in it. And what was great was when we tested it, nobody said, oh, this isn't as funny as the other ones. And so that made me happy because I think it's a really good story and it's very emotional, but it still has big laughs. But I didn't value the laughs as much as I usually do. I'm usually pretty obsessed with like the laugh count and how hard it's crushing.
Well, it's a very funny movie, but it's organically funny. I'm not going to give away too much, but like there's a scene with Bill Burr and his kid and a tattoo, and it's all very plausible and organic, and it's also super funny. And I guess that's what you want. I mean, it's a situation, and Bill Burr's great in this, by the way.
He's amazing.
He's such
a good actor.
I was really, I shouldn't say surprised, although it just flew out of my mouth, but he really shows his acting chops in this movie. There's a scene that is really funny where he meets Marissa Tomei that is completely organic and hysterical and filled with a lot of sort of humanness.
Well, I don't think, you know, his acting career has been his highest priority. You know, he's done a lot of great acting and things, but I think this is the most he's had to do, the most challenging part for him. But from working with him, you would think he had been doing it for the last 30 years as the only thing he does. He just was ridiculously strong and super funny, and also, you know, really cared about the character. He wasn't just trying to score. He really created this person, this like blowhard firefighter who starts dating Pete Davidson's mother.
Right.
And it was just really fun to watch. And I guarantee you, every great moment in that movie was something Bill thought of on the set. I mean, he was a great collaborator for creating that character and being loose and improvising. Most of the special moments there, you know, we worked on together in rehearsals and improvisations. He just brought a ton to it.
Yeah, I was blown away by how great an actor he is. But, you know, unfortunately, we started the show off by, you know, me saying that writer, director, and producer Judd Apatow, but stand-up Judd Apatow. But the way we work is, well, Judd Apatow's a writer and he's a director, and then I guess we'll let him do a little bit of stand-up, and then Bill Burr's a stand-up, and I guess we'll carve out a little room in our brain for him to be an actor as well. But they both things can be true. You can be a great stand-up and be a great actor, and you can be a great director and a great stand-up. We're just not wired to accept that, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we've seen more and more people do it, we realize that it's all part of the same thing. It's storytelling, it's figuring out how to be funny and emotional, and it's all part of your creativity. I mean, Bill is one of the great comedians of all time. You know, when I, you know, work with Bill and get to see him up close, you know, when you see him from 8 feet away from the wings, you realize, oh, there's nobody like this guy. And I'm always amazed at just his energy. Every show feels like it's the last show of his career and he's giving it everything he's got. Just the passion on stage is pretty remarkable. But if anyone wants to see my stand-up, I have a Netflix special. That's the only plug for that I'll do. But it's, you know, it's there. And it's weird that everyone can't do stand-up now. I keep talking to friends and going, are you having a nervous breakdown? And weirdly, nobody is. It doesn't feel like anybody is having that hard a time with giving it a break, because we have friends that haven't taken more than 2 days off in 25 years. So that's a tough change of life.
It is. And I think in a way, maybe it's like a death, you know, like maybe if you said to somebody who was deeply in love with his wife, and if you said, hey, if something happens to Luann, could you go on? And they'd go, no, I couldn't go on. I'd get into a fetal position. I'd never come out. And she dies of breast cancer. And then you see him 6 months later and he introduces you to his new lady friend. And like maybe every stand-up comedian I've known go, if I went 3 days without doing stand-up, I would lose the ability to speak in front of people. Like I couldn't form thoughts or sentences. But there's something that's been a little strange about this self-imposed or governmental imposed Sabbath that we've all been experiencing, where you're almost forced to step off the treadmill and observe the Sabbath. Like, I do think about the Sabbath. I'm not a religious person, but I realize how healthy it is when people observe a Sabbath. You know, it's like, sorry, 1 day a week, I sit and we talk and we don't have the TV on and we have dinner and we have friends over and we share ideas. We don't share pictures from our cell phones. And I go, that's so healthy. I'll never do it. But that's so that's so healthy. And this is, I think, in some ways, for some people, kind of having a forced Sabbath on like a lot of the stand-ups, kind of going, I'm getting off the hamster wheel and I'm going to do something I thought was going to kill me. And as it turns out, I'm finding some nuance in it.
It's so funny because I keep thinking of it as a deathbed moment.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, we're all getting this moment where we might survive, we might not. And we're really thinking, do we like how we spend our lives? Do we like how we're treating people? Do we like where we are, what we're working on? How are things going? You know, in a weird way, that's what Funny People was about. It was about Adam Sandler's character getting sick and then getting this wisdom when he's sick. And then as soon as he gets better, he tosses all the wisdom out the window and tries to get his old life back immediately. And everything caves in. But it is weird for the whole world at the same time to be in the middle of this assessment.
Right.
And as a culture, it'll be interesting to see when everything gets back to normal, who doesn't act exactly the same way they did before this happened? Does anyone make any real changes, dramatic changes off of this?
Well, you know, I was talking about it in these terms a few weeks ago. I was thinking about the near-death experience and how that's supposed to change your life, you know, and I'm trying to think of if you, and someone should do this, just find out everybody who was on the flight Captain Sully landed in the Hudson River and go, yeah, have you changed at all? Because there was a 7-minute period when you were probably going to die. Like you knew, look, if you find out you have pancreatic cancer, that's horrible information, but it plays out over the next series of months. You know, we're going to have to figure out a treatment or do, you know, what do we do? That moment, like the moment I don't know, Chris, you can look it up, but from the time there was that bird strike to the time he set it down in the Hudson, that was probably 4 minutes, 5 minutes. It was definitely enough time for you to be on that plane and have a near-death experience. None of those people got a scratch on them. Did they go back and mistreat their stepson that following day?
I think this is your next documentary.
This is a
great documentary idea.
It really is. I mean, all their names are on a manifest somewhere. You can find out all. We could go interview all of them and find out if it – because sadly, just like winning the lottery, I don't think it changes things.
I'll say this. Maybe not, but I'm glad that we have found our first collaboration. I feel like this is the moment, and we're going to do it, and we're gonna find at least 50 of those people and ask them if they made any adjustment. Well, you know, when we did Funny People, part of the inspiration was I read a couple of articles from big people in the movie business and TV, and they were talking about how they you know, there was this one guy who ran a TV network, and he was saying, he thought he was going to die. And he said, you know, when I was sick, I realized we can be number one again. And I just thought it was such a crazy thought. Like, that's what he thought when he thought he was going to die was, you know what? I think we can be number one in the ratings again. And I think there are those people that nothing touches them. It doesn't get to them. They don't, you know, adjust in any way.
3 hours. Sorry.
I'm giving you times here. So
okay.
3:15 was takeoff. 3:27 PM. They noticed the bird slurry, they called it. And then 3:35 PM, miracle on the Hudson.
Right. So 8 minutes or so. That's enough time to contemplate. That's an eternity when you're thinking you're going to die. So watching the movie, The King of Staten Island, first off, Pete Davidson really came across really nicely, like very vulnerable, very, very likable, like you're really rooting for him. I was thinking about you and I was thinking about me because I was thinking about those guys, Pete and his sort of crew, early 20s, no direction, kind of hanging around, ripping bong loads, watching The Purge, and no direction, just rudderless. And I thought, I remember being that age and a little bit younger. I think Pete was playing a 24-year-old in the movie. Being after high school and before I got somewhat established as a carpenter, it was like 18 to 25. And this sense, the scariest feeling, the scariest feeling wasn't fear. It was no direction, just nothing. Yeah. I had no idea what I was doing and neither did anyone around me. And I dreaded that feeling. I would have wanted to just join the Marines or be incarcerated or like have something. I had nothing to do and I felt like sort of helpless. You always knew comedy, always wanted to do comedy, always were like laser focused on it. What were you doing when you were Pete's age in the movie?
Yeah, I was fully working hard at that moment. I mean, my background was just, I was very nervous about supporting myself. I didn't really feel like anybody could support me. And I think out of just fear and my own hyper vigilance from the youngest age, like 10, I'm like, I got to get a job. I mean, I was literally thinking that as a really little kid, like you got to know what you're doing. And you have to stay focused. And I was very neurotic about it. My grandfather was a jazz producer, so I knew that he had created this career from nothing as a kid in the 40s and just chased around Charlie Parker and people like that and begged them to let him record them. So I knew there was a way to succeed in show business if you were a hustler in some way, but it was very fear-driven. So by the time I was 24, I mean, I was producing the Ben Stiller show on Fox. I met Ben Stiller. I was doing stand-up and producing some stand-up specials for people. And I produced a couple of Tom Arnold specials, three Tom Arnold specials and Roseanne's special. And I didn't have that much experience. And I met Stiller and we pitched a sketch show to HBO and they bought it and then they sold it to Fox. So we were kids and we thought we were going to do some fringe cable sketch show. And then suddenly we were on Fox up against 60 Minutes and I had no experience and I was just winging it, trying to figure out how to do it. And I would sit in my office really embarrassed that everyone on the crew was older than me. I felt terrible that I was in charge of anything. And I would read Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I didn't know how to manage like 100 people. I really was very overwhelmed by the responsibility of running a writing staff and just getting the show delivered. And I would sit in my room and listen to self-help tapes. And one just said over and over again, I am at peace with the world and everybody in it. I am at peace with the world and everybody in it. Because I was so stressed. And when it got canceled, there was a part of me that was like, thank God I have no gas in the tank. We've made 13 episodes and I feel like we've been doing this for 25 years. It was really a lot of work.
You mentioned hypervigilance, which Dr. Drew diagnosed me with many, many years ago. And I'm glad you brought it up because I had this experience last night. Last night, I went outside because I was fiddling around with the outdoor lighting or whatever it is. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I went out the back sliding door and I was standing in the dark in my backyard. I watched my son get up and I saw him walking past the long bank of sliding glass doors. And my first thought was, oh, I don't want to scare him, like, because I'll look like a shadowy figure out in the backyard, mm-hmm. and he'll have no context. They'll think a prowler's in the backyard. So I sort of made sure to not do anything or catch his attention or whatever. But I noticed that he was just looking at his phone And he just walked right on past. He never glanced. He never looked at the bank of windows or into the dark yard or any of that. Then he walked around into the kitchen. I was like, okay, I don't want to be standing here because he's going to see me in the window. The point is, he never looked up. He never looked up, and he got his food, and he went back in his room. And then I thought to myself, oh, that kid feels safe. Because when I was a kid, I would have done a shoulder roll into the living room and then popped my head up and then looked right and left and then crawled on my elbows into the kitchen looking for prowlers, looking for people outside, feeling vulnerable, like I couldn't be protected. So somehow the feeling of vulnerability turns you into – it turns into hypervigilance. Like when you see – the way animals that live in trees act when they're on the ground. You know what I mean? Like always looking like, okay, now I'm vulnerable.
Yeah.
I'm not 18 feet in the air. I could get run over or eaten by a coyote. Like my head's on a swivel. So does the hypervigilance exist sort of organically, or is it created because you feel vulnerable?
Well, I think that, you know, what I've learned in therapy over the last few years is that we're all in a state of hype of a some sort of fight or flight at all times, right? And so in evolution, as it has been explained to me, you would be very aware of who's going to try to eat me.
Right.
And so our brains are literally designed to avoid getting eaten. So we're built to get scared and run real fast or freeze. And that none of that really applies to the modern world. So we're constantly overreacting. Our nervous system is literally built to run away from a bear.
Right.
And so I think, and then if you had any trauma as a kid, all of that is jacked up.
Right. So I grew up with parents that I didn't think would protect me if somebody broke into the house. So I had that kind of sleep with one eye open because you're on your own. My son... Yeah. Just based on the way he walked from his room to the kitchen last night, doesn't possess that same fear, and rightfully so. It would be irrational if he did. But how did you grow up? Did you have that sense where your parents would take care of you?
Well, my parents, you know, were very loving, but they got into a terrible divorce when I was finishing up middle school, like a really bad divorce that never got resolved. It never calmed down. 10 years later, it was still unresolved. Right. And I think that put me in a state of hyper vigilance and it made me very nervous. It made, you know, when your parents fight a lot, whenever they're fighting, someone's wrong, right? So if either of your parents is clearly way off and really wrong and overreacting and emotional and flipping out, as a little kid, you go, oh, I can't trust their advice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what it did to me, as great as they also were. Part of me went like, I think you got to figure out some of this shit yourself. Because if these people can't even work their divorce out, you can't listen to a lot of their advice. They're going to be hit and miss at best. And it made me a more nervous person. And then the hard part is that is the reason for all my success. All my success is driven by this like terror of not succeeding. And as a parent, we're trying to make our kids really comfortable and happy and solid, but hope they still have ambition and that they're, you know, like for me, like, yeah, I work hard because I'm afraid it's all going to cave in. But
right.
Can you work really hard without that kind of madness that drives you? And as you get older, you're trying to get rid of it. And then I feel like I'm less nuts with all that. And I still work hard, but I'm not as crazed as I was at 30, mm-hmm. which is probably good because I was, you know, I was doing too much and being too hard on myself. And I don't think it makes the work better. And you slowly realize, oh, the work isn't better because I'm hypervigilant and crazy all day. It's a lot of wasted energy.
To some degree. So what I mean is you're hypervigilant and you know the difference between a product where you're in the edit bay and one where you're not in the edit bay. And or how much time you spend in the edit bay, right? Because that hypervigilance pays dividends in the edit bay, right? There's just things you notice that other people won't can't and will never notice. So it's like there is a positive thing to do with that. The problem is you have to be able to shut it off and leave the edit bay at some point. And go home, right?
And not be that lunatic when you get home. And right. That was something that took me a long time to get better at, which is you're in almost a state when you're at work. You're almost shaking from working hard and focusing and trying not to screw anything up and looking for problems that haven't happened yet to solve them before they even happen. And then you come home and you're supposed to be super mellow and mirroring your children and a normal person and just loving and free. And that's a rough transition. I mean, I remember I used to go home and I would just have to take a shower when I got home just for my brain to switch into a more normal gear.
Well, we were talking about hypervigilance. And it struck me when you said that your parents, that you kind of knew early on that these people weren't going to make good decisions for you. You felt like it was up to you. I had that feeling in spades. I always tell people all the time, like, I learned early on these two weren't going to make good decisions, for me. Yeah. And thus, there's a vulnerability that you feel that our kids don't feel because we have led them to believe we're much more competent than maybe we even are.
I mean, I really feel like you need to screw up your kids just enough so they want to get the hell out of the house, you know? I do think I've accomplished that. You know, my daughter Maude is in the movie King of Staten Island. She plays Pete's sister. And she's on that show Euphoria and that TV show Hollywood, and she's working her ass off. And I'm like, I may have screwed her up perfect.
Just the perfect amount.
A perfect amount. She's responsible, but creative and neurotic enough to be interesting, and she does a great job.
Now, a kid is like a poached egg, which is you don't want it raw and all running all over the place, and you don't want it hard boiled. There's that sweet spot where there's just a little of that yellow in the middle, and if you screw them up just enough, you'll get the perfect poached egg. Sorry, you were saying.
I can't say that I did a better job than my parents, and I can't say that my parents did a bad job. I mean, everything's going well, but that's how I felt as a little kid. I'm sure that they did most everything very well, but as a little kid, the idea that there were these two people and they made me, I'm half him, I'm half her, and they hate each other, create something psychological in me. Like, I don't know, if I'm with my mom and she's mad at my dad, I think I'm kind of like him, you know? And I think you just get a lot of confused feelings about who you are when there's just so much strife. And also back then, no one talked about their feelings. I mean, they never really sat me down and said, hey, let's go to a therapist or let's kind of work through what's going on. There was a lot of just denial. There was no conversations about how's this affecting you? How are you doing? Well, I've told this story before, but my dad left out a book on a coffee table that was called Growing Up Divorced with the hope that on my own, I would read it. And here's the weird thing. I did read it and it was helpful. I didn't know he left it there for me to read. I thought it was just his book. But years later, I said to my dad, how did you know I read it? Like, you didn't even know I read it. And he just was like, I hoped you'd read it. And I'm like, but you never asked me if I read it. Like, you didn't know I read it. He just left a book out and hoped that would solve the problem.
The type of parenting that was done then versus now is people can't believe how far we've traveled in such a short period of time. But I do, I think a lot of it, like, people thought nothing about smoking in front of kids back in the day. Get in a car, roll the windows up, light a Winston, smoking in restaurants, eating out with your kids, whatever it is. I think adults did kind of the same thing with arguing and other things that were far more dangerous than secondhand smoke.
Oh, like, sure. Just screaming in front of us. They wouldn't hesitate to just scream at each other with kids around.
Right. And, we've both been married for a while and we've had our dust ups, but always super careful to do it in a way that's not within earshot of the kids. And, like, I could remember my mom locking herself in her bedroom and just yelling freak out as loud as she could. And I was like standing outside her bedroom going, oh my God, now I'm freaked out as well, because you're basically the captain of the ship and you're screaming into the intercom. You have no idea what's going on. And that,
I knew my parents were getting divorced because I heard them through the wall.
Really?
And then they told me like a couple of weeks later, but like I had heard the whole discussion through the wall.
You were what age at that time?
Well, that literally happened in seventh grade. Then they got back together and then they broke up again after ninth grade. And, you know, the '70s was that was a completely different time. I remember my dad reading this self-help book, Your Erogenous Zones. And we always said that was the book that made him want to get divorced. He finally read something about his feelings. He finally read something that you know, helped him figure out if he was happy or not happy. And that was all new in the '70s. You know, people were just beginning to consider those things. You know, these were World War II kids and their parents didn't express themselves openly and talk about what they were going through.
I wonder if there's a renaissance for that in today's society, meaning, it was funny. I was talking to Rob Lowe sort of about this subject. We're all generally the same age. And he was explaining that his mom and his dad did sort of the same thing. Like they went on some sort of journey instead of raising their kids, you know, like my mom did the same thing. She got a biorhythm wheel to figure out if it was an extra critical day or not, you know, and started going like, you know, so what happened was, is you have a 10-year-old kid and at some point you have this epiphany and you go, I've never worked on myself. You know what? I'm going to start focusing on me. And it's like, that's great, but you have a 10-year-old. So there's an interesting version of that going on now, a much healthier version, but there's a lot of like 50-year-olds are like, I'm getting into meditation and I'm going full vegan and I'm going to go to retreats and I'm going to go to primal scream therapy and stuff. And it's good, but there's still an element of what about the kid while you're over here?
We try to tell the kids about it now. You know, like we try to get our kids to meditate and we try to get our kids to, you know, understand how their mind works and talk to someone if they feel like talking to somebody. And it is a very different conversation. And we've always been open with them in a way my parents haven't. I mean, we'll say to our kids, like, you know, we're normal people. We have problems. You know, we don't present ourselves as perfect beings who you better listen to or we're going to kick the shit out of you. I mean, that's kind of what it felt like to me as a kid. Well, it's like, you're in charge. And if I get in trouble, it's going to get messed up here. Like I was scared of my parents, of doing things and getting in trouble. And it's not like they did anything, but that was, you know, a generation that threatened a lot.
Right.
There was a lot of threats but we're not like that with our kids in the sense that we go like, we're not perfect. And I'm going to tell you how I'm not perfect. And you can call me on my shit and I'll tell you why maybe I mishandled something. And I think that's generally a better way to do it so that they go, okay, my dad's a real person. And this is, you know, here are his issues. Sometimes this is the thing that upsets him for this reason. And hopefully that's a better way to do it. If anything, I'm annoying them like, hey, you want to meditate? Let's go put on the Calm app for a little, little while, you know, because you want them to learn the lessons you learned at 50 at 17. And there's no way they will because you got to go through it. But maybe you can give them a little head start.
So for you, this movie's a real, I don't know what to call it. Maturation or something. It's a really strong film and it's got a ton of heart, although I always hate when people say that, but it does.
I don't mind.
And it's got a lot of laughs and it's like, I feel like it's what Judd Apatow has been evolving into over the last few years, the king of Staten Island. So for you, are there things you want to do? Can you do anything you want? You know, I interviewed, who did I interview? It wasn't Scorsese, it was Coppola. And I interviewed him like 10 years ago, and he said, I'd like to make this movie and that movie, but they'll only let me make this movie and that movie. And it's surprising when you talk to people that are very accomplished or had Hall of Fame type careers, and then they kind of explain how I can't really do this. I could only do that. Is there something you want to do, or is there things you want to do and feel like they won't let you do it, or you're going to have to do it on your own, or there are things that have nothing to do with show business or Hollywood that you'd like to discuss?
Well, I think that it's all about the budget. You know, Scorsese wants to do these movies that are very, very expensive. All right,
Coppola, sorry. Yeah. I screwed that up.
I mean, well, Coppola, I never quite understood. You know, I think he was more experimental. I mean, he really wanted to do things that people had not done and tell stories that were not necessarily the types of stories that mainstream America was seeking out. And then it really is like, well, how much money do you need to do it?
Right.
You know, do you need $3 million? Do you need $45 million? And, you know, that's a business. You have to figure out how you're going to play the game. And Scorsese clearly found a way to score enough times that he's given these opportunities to do something like The Irishman. Just yesterday, they said they're greenlighting his other movie, which is $150 million Western with Leonardo DiCaprio and De Niro, I think, that Eric Roth wrote. So it's really how much money you're asking of people. Like for me, I don't need that much. I'm not making cheap movies, but I'm making movies basically for the same budgets I have for the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not suddenly going like, but now I need 120 to do it. Like it's kind of the same scope. And the one thing that I am allowed to do is they will let me make a movie with someone who isn't a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's kind of what I like to do, which is get people excited because they don't know the star, or right, they know them, but they haven't seen them be the star. For me, it's more exciting to show, you know, Pete Davidson and Bill Burr and Ricky Velez and a lot of people you don't know, because I think the audience loves that. They love to discover somebody.
Right.
And that's the thing that, because it's worked a bunch of times, they'll allow me to do that not everyone is allowed to do.
Is there something you want to do that maybe they don't want you to do?
No, I don't even have that many ideas. I have no stack of thoughts. You know, I like usually I finally think of a thought and then I try to figure out how to get someone to let me do it. But I don't have, I literally have almost zero movie ideas sitting around. So it's not like I have a stack of my rejected things. Usually when things don't happen, it's because the actor or the actress turned me down. And I thought of something that's so specific to someone. And then they say, I don't want to do it. And then there kind of isn't anyone else who can do it. Mm-hmm. And then it dies because of that.
The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling is a great doc. It's a multi-series doc, right?
I think two parts.
Yeah. That was great. And whenever we talk off the air, we always sort of talk about docs. Any thoughts about any subjects for docs? Or, you know, I make a lot of docs about cars. I feel like maybe you doing them about comedians sounds
yes,
like you're pretty exactly qualified for that.
Yeah, I mean, we're excited. You know, we're talking about making a documentary about George Carlin. Mm. And that's somebody that hasn't had that kind of treatment before. And he's been so important in so many different eras of comedy. So I'm very excited, especially now that the world is so weird and crumbling in so many ways. When you look back at his last few specials, when he was really angry and did some dark comedy, people have started passing around these bits. You see them on the internet all the time, and they all sadly apply to a lot of things that we see happening in the world.
Yeah, like when he was talking about the immune system and growing up and jumping into the river and being exposed to all the germs and all that stuff. Yeah, you know, the thing that's really interesting about a real philosopher like George Carlin, like a guy who really studied life, is when you think about some of the things that some of the classic philosophers said, you know, Plato or whomever from, what you know, thousands of years ago, they all sound perfectly apt for today. Like, and you realize the thing about, I think it's like great design. You know, something that was architecture from the 70s looks like shit today, but really great Art Deco design looks awesome today. And music, you know, disco-y, early 80s, Flock of Seagulls, synth rock, you know, it sounds horrible and dated, but really good music. The Beatles, George Harrison, Graham Parker, thank you. Timeless sort of stuff. And I feel that way about comedy, right? Like, George, so what Carlin is doing is a philosophy, and it's sort of timeless because good philosophy is always true.
Yeah, his stuff doesn't age, and a lot of comedy has aged really badly, and his doesn't. There's an amazing bit that goes around the internet where he says about government that you don't have any rights. You just have the rights that they want you to think you have.
Right.
And it's a really remarkable long routine where he just talks about the entire game being rigged. And, you know, I've never been conspiratorial, but you feel like the world has become more and more transparent, where you see the relationships between countries and government and what is allowed to happen and what are people's motivations for doing things. And it is hard not to think that a lot of what George Carlin said about financial interests controlling the government and how a lot of what we think is reality isn't. It's like meant to sedate you so you won't question anything. That was a big thing he talked about. They want you on your gadgets. They don't want you to get a good education so that you don't pay attention to what's happening.
Well, I have a thought I'm going to tease because I got to run a quick spot here. But I realize with guys like Carlin and others where you go, well, what information do you have? Do you have documents that are unredacted? Or what have you gotten your hands on that gives you this information? But in a way, if you have a brain like George Carlin, you have all the information because you're always reading the tea leaves around you. You don't need documents. Sure. You know what I mean? You have a way of thinking that has such clarity to it that you can suss these things out. Other people need evidence. You have your own divining rod, your brain, and you see so much truth where other people don't. We'll talk about that in a second. First, let me hit True Niagen. Heard about the trend of NAD boosters? There's only one backed by both clinical research and regulatory approvals. True Niagen. From age 40 to 60, humans experience a near 50% decline in NAD, leaving the mitochondria to compete for a shrinking supply of their most valuable energetic resource. Stress on the immune system, lack of exercise, overeating can all also deplete NAD because cells have to expand for more energy function. I take True Niagen on a daily basis. Shannon Sharp, who's in phenomenal shape, does as well. I talked to him the other day. So do many folks who they don't talk about it. They just do it. And I talked to the owner of the company, and he's really onto something here. I've been on it, it's about 4 months now. True Niagen, you can visit TRUNIAGEN.com and use the code Adam, get $20 off your first 3 month supply or 3 month plus supply. Now until May 31st, so get going, but try it and notice a difference. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come right back with Judd Apatow and finish up right after this.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Adam, Big Pink, calling you from City Island, New York. Do we really need douchebag, dirtbag, and scumbag? What's the difference?
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Well, I've been lobbying for a long time to get rid of douchebag and replace it with douche nozzle, which is far more offensive and gets the job done. So in my world, we can get rid of dirtbag and douchebag, and we'll just switch it to douche nozzle. And if you'd like me to put it in a sentence, Judd Apatow, I will happily do it. It could work on the construction site when, like, the foreman sure. came around. Hey, you douche nozzles, get back to work. There's that version of it. There's the one where you cut off the cab driver and he calls you a douche nozzle when he pumps his fist at you. It's got a lot of applications.
We got to switch up the curses a little bit. They're getting repetitive at this point.
Well, you know, it was funny. Our production company, me and Jimmy Kimmel and Daniel Kelson's production company, is called Jack Hole Productions. And Jack Hole Productions came from when Jimmy and I were on the radio. They'd say, you can say titties, but you can't say tits. And you can say God and damn, but you can't say God damn it. And they had like a whole bunch of dumb rules. And Jimmy set out to think of a new swear word. And he came up with jackhole.
And then they let it through.
They let it through because George Carlin had not given the seven words you can't say. I mean, literally, the FCC built their rules around George Carlin's seven dirty words.
I remember we said something sucks on Fox, and they said, you can't say sucks. You have to say what you are sucking. It can't be like, you suck. I was like, you suck eggs, or it could be balls. You know, you have to know what you're sucking.
They would do this thing where they would go, you can say you're pissed off, and you can say you're taking a piss, but you can't say you pissed on your girlfriend. Like, it was like, when I was doing the man show with Jimmy, we said, how much ass crack can you show? And they said, you can show some ass crack, like if you're doing a plumber's bit on SNL and Dan Aykroyd's the Norge man or something. But hey, they said, they thought about it and they said, you can show 3/4 ass crack. So
3/4 of the total crack?
Of the total crack. So we invented 3/4 ass crack shorts to put on all the Juggy Dance Squads. It was simpler times. So are you moving forward with the George Carlin doc or just thinking about it?
No, we're about to start. We haven't started yet, but we have the full Gary Shandling team, and that's a multi-year project, but we're very excited to do that.
And how does it begin for you? Obviously there's a lot of research.
Yeah, I mean, I think it a lot of it for him is absorbing the material, all the specials, and trying to figure out the arc of his thinking. You know, how did his thinking evolve from the 60s till his last special? There's the personal side, there's the creative side. I think we're very interested in the creative side and how it applies to today. You know, what did he talk about that we're now seeing in action today?
And do you in advance sort of think, well, this has got to be a three-parter because the guy's breadth and width of his career was so great, or does someone else decide that?
I mean, it's a two-parter, and I think I like that format, you know, like two long parts. But, you know, I enjoyed 10 parts of Michael Jordan. I was fully there. I as a fan of documentaries, when they're working, they don't have to end. I can watch an hour of a good documentary, you know, once a week for a really long time.
You're right. There's no expiration date. I watched the 10 The Last Dance episodes like eating a bowl of cereal in 2 minutes, and I was done, and I was like, I need a second bowl. Where is it? Like the following, I had a little bit of post-traumatic stress disorder the following week when I turn on the TV on Sunday, and it's like, oh, that's it. All 10 are gone.
Yeah, it was too good. It was like The Sopranos in a way. Like when you knew The Sopranos was ending, you're like, oh man, there's only like 3 more Sopranos. It definitely had that feeling of something special. You wanted to go on and on. I'm hoping at some point someone will put on the internet the edit of it before Michael Jordan gave any notes. Like, here's the cut before he said, yeah, lose that section. I don't want to talk about that. I don't get the sense that he did a lot of that, but it would be really interesting to know what was too far.
It's funny, our relationship with guys like Jordan, because there's a part of us that hates the bully in him, and then there's another part that respects the shit out of essentially the same qualities that made him the bully. And yeah. I don't know where you come down on that. Like, how do you
feel? On that approach? Well, I don't know, because I'm not an athlete, so you know, I could listen to him say, you know, if you can't take shit from me, how are you going to be able to handle it during the big game? But I think, like, you know, that's not really how most teams function. I don't think that's why the Boston Celtics were great, or, you know, why the Lakers were great in that era, because someone was screaming at them like that the entire time. It may have worked for that team. I mean, obviously what they accomplished is ridiculous, but the Golden State Warriors, that's not how that team functions. So it's hard to know if it really motivates people. The question should be given to the people around him to go, if he didn't yell at you, do you think you still would have played well? Like, right. Did you need that, or were you going to work your ass off anyway?
I think the rule is someone is allowed to yell at you to do things as long as they're doing the exact same thing they're yelling about. I think the problem comes, we see it with the government all the time, where they say, here's what you got to do, and then we find out they're doing something else.
Or they're, like the president not wearing a mask.
Right. You can't say do this and then go not do that. That's exactly right. That's where it breaks off. I think Jordan yelled at everyone to do 7/8 of what he was already doing. And I think that's effective, or could be effective. If he just yelled at people to do it and then he did half of what he was yelling about, then it would never work, right?
Well, it was interesting because I just watched the Lance Armstrong documentary.
Yes. I watched that.
There's certainly, it certainly felt like there were some commonalities in terms of people who just burn so hot to win. They're just going to tear the village down to make it happen. There is a madness, and, you know, people who can decade after decade spend that much time on a bike, that much time in a gym, and the focus never weakens. It doesn't soften. And you see it in Lance Armstrong's eyes. You see it in Jordan's eyes. Like, Jordan laughing at the other players when they hand him the computer.
Right.
They try to say that they were good, and he just laughs at them.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of that with Lance Armstrong too, where he kept saying over and over, wouldn't change a thing. Really?
Yeah.
Nothing?
I know.
Wouldn't change anything. But that is, the competitiveness is still there, and they don't know what to do with it. It's still in their minds.
Well, you know, as I was watching the Lance Armstrong story, I was thinking about, he starts off as a triathlete, and all that is pure will. You know, I mean, you can see Jordan had a 42-inch vertical. You don't have that. You're not dunking from the free throw line. But Lance Armstrong, when he was 15, was like competing in triathlons against professionals, and he was competitive and even winning. And you realize that's all will. I mean, yeah, some people are a little stronger than others, and some people have a little more endurance than others. But what you're going to swim 2 miles, you're going to run a marathon, you're going to ride your bike 100 miles. It's 100% will. That's what that guy is. And Jordan is what happens when you take Lance Armstrong's will and put it into a guy who's 6'7" and has a 40-inch vertical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, Kobe was like that. You know, all those people, they're the first person in every day, last person to leave, but for decades. I mean, that's what's interesting to me. And I see it in comedy. You see it with Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle is working harder than everybody. In addition to just being great, he is out there busting his ass, doing long shows, you know, just writing and And it's there's also the will in the creative community. I mean, look at Scorsese. He's like a Michael Jordan guy. He's you know, deep in his 70s, about to take on another $150 million movie. The amount of energy and focus and passion to still want to do that. Bob Dylan's about to put out a double album, I hear, this summer. He's 79 years old.
Well, last question for you, Judd, because I know you have a heart out, and don't worry, I'll give the movie the plugs and the praise. So I personally sometimes feel like I don't want to squander my opportunities and or talent. Like, so what kind of drives me a lot is just sort of, well, there's so many good subjects for docs, and I want to say I did as many of them as I could, or I have so many jokes to tell, or as sort of a squandered opportunity. You left something on the table. Money, ability. Do you know what I'm saying? How does that resonate with you?
I try to flip the whole thing as a mental trick for myself, which is I like to think that my career is over and this is the aftermath. Mm. And that makes me less stressed. You know, if I feel like I need to be in a certain place or at the top of my game or having a certain output, that makes me really nervous and it doesn't make me creative. So in my head, what I think is, my career is over, and this is like the sputtering out of a couple of other things. Like, remember when Dylan put out Time Out of Mind, and he hadn't had an incredible album in a while. And out of the blue, you're like, oh my God, that might be the best one.
Right.
That's how I like to look at my career now. Like, it's over, and maybe every once in a while I might make something that's like Time Out of Mind, and that makes me not worry, because the worry kicks up my critic and makes me not work as hard. So I like to think that I retired 20 years ago, but then every once in a while I put out an album on an indie label.
Well, his Time Out of Mind for this generation is the king of Staten Island. I watched it in its entirety last night, and it is a great film. It's available on demand coming up on June 12th. Please watch it and watch some great performances and some great direction and great writing as well. Judd, we'll talk to you very soon. Thanks for stepping in.
Yes, thank you very much. Take care. Be well, everybody.
All right, let me hit Geico right here. You were sharing your stuff online, your dance moves, your DIY haircut fails, your inner lip sync star. How about Geico does a little sharing? So good news, 15% credit on your car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Geico's committed for the long haul. And look, they know you're not doing as much driving as you did a few months ago, and they're sharing some of it, kicking some of it back, 15% credit. Last, your full policy term. Go to geico.com/giveback and find out how you can get in on this. Live, by the way, Adam Carolla's Unprepared. We're doing it from quarantine Monday, 7 o'clock Pacific. And you can register now at SiriusXM.com/Adam Carolla and watch me perform live from my house like we did it a few weeks ago. Nashville Zanies coming up June 12th and 13th. We're doing some live podcasts and some stand-up over there. So get those tickets before they sell out. I'm your emotional support animal, which is a new book out on the 16th. Pre-order it. It just helps. And until next time, Sam Kroll for Vinny Tortorich, Judd Apatow, and Bald Brian and Gina Grand saying mahalo.
Follow Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And you can watch this broadcast at youtube.com/Adam Carolla. Pre-order Adam's book. It's out June 16th. Get all the links at adamcarolla.com.